This is the News Roundup on CAI. I'm Steve Junker. It is Friday, February 28th, final day of February. We are discussing the week's top local stories with reporters and editors from around the region. Today on the program, we'll be hearing from CAI's Eve Zukoff and Jeanette Barnes. We'll speak with Louisa Hufstetter of the Vineyard Gazette and Tim Wood of the Cape Cod Chronicle. We'll hear from William Von Herf of the Provincetown Independent and David Creed of Nantucket Current, and we'll speak with Sarah Shaw Dawson of the Martha's Vineyard Times. Now to some of the news around the Cape, the coast, and the islands. A massive house in Wellfleet, perched on an eroding bluff, is no more. On Monday, demolition crews leveled the so-called Blash House, which has been at the center of years-long controversy. CAI's Eve Zukoff was there to watch it come down, and she joins us now. Hi, Eve.
Hi, Steve.
Describe the scene as this house came down. It's at the edge of a bluff, and I know you watched at least part of it from the beach below. From what you reported, I was surprised by how fast the demolition seemed to go.
It went very fast. I arrived at 11:30 to find two excavators had already that morning demolished about a third of the house, which is, as people know, kind of like tilting towards Cape Cod Bay. Neighbors told me the excavators began by ripping off the roof and the second floor of this 5,100 square foot home. And then I watched as these claws worked on the first floor, pulling off wood siding and shingles and floorboards and putting them in dumpsters. I really want to point out here, actually, how well this house was built. It's not typical to see the massive steel beams that we saw holding it up. And it's really something to look at the thick pilings that go 35 feet down into the earth. This was not a builder-grade chintzy thing. It was really built to withstand some things. And that is part of the reason the cabinets, windows, and doors were actually salvaged by Habitat for Humanity earlier. But I do want to mention that as kind of the demolition was happening, some little pieces of debris would tumble down the bluff as the excavators worked, and there were two guys in hard hats with rakes that were in charge of collecting basically everything they could. And then by 1:30, there was just one room left on the far side of the house that was recognizable. It was clearly a great room with these big wooden beams and white shiplap walls and a ceiling fan that wasn't on, but a gentle breeze was kind of making it spin. And by 2, that was destroyed, and the outer wall of the home that faces the ocean was pulled down with considerable effort, actually, to a pile of rubble.
This is a home that's captured the attention of lots of people for some more reasons that we'll get into. But I'm curious about the spectators who came out to witness this morning. What kinds of reactions did you hear from them?
Yeah, there were a lot of people, really curious people. They were taking photos, kind of shaking their heads and smiling at each other as they walked past. I talked with a couple from Yarmouthport, Ernie and Judy Barassa. Judy told me it was actually heartwarming to see the house come down. She said, you know, having hiked out here for the last 10 years, watching it get close to the edge, or rather the edge getting closer to it, it was getting worse and worse. And March is approaching. And she noted, like, that can be our worst time on Cape Cod as far as storms. And we know that this house, from one report commissioned by the town last year, basically would have fallen within 3 years. So, and we've heard it's one storm away. So we could have gotten that storm and really been in for a disaster. So anyway, she said it's a blessing to watch it come down this way. And then her husband Ernie jumped in. He said it's also frustrating. It's frustrating that this house was built in the first place.
Let's go there, because the backstory here matters quite a bit. This was not an old house. Explain how it came to be here at the bluff's edge.
Yeah, no, built in 2010. The original owners were Mark and Barbara Blash. They built the house. In 2018, they saw how much erosion was endangering the home. So they asked the town for permission to build about a 240-foot wide seawall in front of it. The Wellfleet Conservation Commission rejected that proposal because seawalls really come at a major cost to coastlines. Like, wave action bounces off of them and then quickly erodes the beach below. And wave action then bites down harder on the land on either side of a seawall. It's also worth mentioning the state banned homeowners from installing new seawalls if they weren't already built by 1978. And then in 2022, a New York attorney bought the house from the Blash family for more than $5 million, despite the fact that the bluffs had receded by about 50 feet since 2014. There's been some good reporting out there that he was actually in the midst of a manic episode from bipolar. So I know there's a lot of kind of charges that how could someone do this? But I think it's worth urging some empathy here. His fight with the town got even more contentious last year when a commissioned report again found that the home was quite likely to collapse very soon. And then if that happened, debris, and we're talking heavy stuff, but also toxic stuff like fiberglass and refrigerants, could end up in Wellfleet Harbor and really crush the whole Wellfleet oyster industry. So locals have called this the most hated home in town.
That's a lot of backstory there. I'm wondering, is this an environment story about coastal erosion, or is this a story about a fight over regulations that protect the coastline over the rights of property owners? How should we be thinking about this?
I love this question because I think there isn't a clear answer. You know, a lot of people see this as a story of greed. One person I ran into on the beach was Brian McCormack, probably the most interesting person I could have found down there. He is the coastal processes and hazards specialist for Hui Sea Grant. So he actually wrote the report that found the house would soon fall. And he looked at it and said, this is a sign of what's to come. Like, that's what this story is. He hears from homeowners all the time in many towns across the Cape who tell them their homes are in precarious places because of climate change, which is speeding up sea level rise and erosion and bringing more intense storms. And it's really hard to do the right thing because what is the right thing? Do you sell the house and put someone else in the crummy situation? Do you demolish the house and lose that nest egg for your family? Do you leave it up to hope and prayers? I mean, basically, he pointed to this really true looming thing that the Blash House has been the poster child of the war between Mother Nature and human desire on Cape Cod. But there will be others that follow the same example.
Okay, I want to do a hard pivot to another story you have been covering this week. Governor Maura Healey announced she is pausing plans to close the Pocasset Mental Health Center. Give us the background here.
Yeah, last month she announced her initial plans to shutter the Pocasset Mental Health Center and actually the Canton-based Pappas Rehabilitation Hospital for Children. This is all because of state budget concerns. But the Pocasset Mental Health Center is a 16-bed facility. It's one of just two facilities on the Cape, for the Cape and Islands, that helps people in crisis who are in need of mental health stabilization. We're talking real crises with depression, bipolar, PTSD. So the idea that basically half the beds, mental health beds on Cape Cod, could be closed was met with a huge outcry.
Half the beds of a very limited number to begin with, insufficient number to begin with, many would say.
Yes.
So a huge outcry at this. You covered one public meeting, and there has also been, along with that, a lot of expression of public sentiment asking for this not to happen. What role did all of that seem to play in the governor's decision?
It's clear that it was huge. Look, first and foremost, she's a politician, and she heard overwhelming feedback from patients, from families, from staff in the last few weeks. The Massachusetts Nurses Association, mental health workers and advocates, and really interestingly, our local officials, our state senators, the sheriff of Barnstable County, who pointed out at a public meeting that more than 150 people came to earlier this month, that if you close this facility, there will be more people in the emergency room. There will be more people in our jails. So she got an earful, Governor Healey. She also kind of couldn't escape it. There was a change.org petition to save the facility that got, as of last night, more than 2,500 signatures. It was wall to wall. And so she, I think, had kind of no choice but to listen.
How about reaction now? This is she has paused where we are in the process. So many people paying attention to this. What you went out and kind of tried to take the temperature of the room. What's the reaction here?
Yeah, there's a ton of excitement. In fact, when I called someone with the Massachusetts Nurses Association, I could hear cheering from a rally at the State House just in the background of our phone call this week. And people are celebrating because this facility really saves lives. The Pocasset Mental Health Center is what they say. But excitement has been tempered by two things. First of all, Healey stopped short of a reversal, saying that she now wants to bring together a diverse group of stakeholders. This includes families and local officials and healthcare professionals and patients to review care and develop recommendations on the best path forward for the Pocasset Mental Health Center. And then second of all, in her latest statement, Healy did not address whether she was changing plans to cut the state's mental health caseworker staff in half. That was part of the original kind of, you know, we're doing a lot of cuts. And if that happens, advocates for mental health in Massachusetts believe that 4,000 people across the state will lose access to mental health services. So that will mean emergency rooms, fire departments, jails will be overwhelmed.
What happens next with the Pocasset Mental Health Center? What's the next stage?
Well, there's no details yet on meetings between the governor and these stakeholders. I think there are a lot more conversations to be had, including a broader one that you mentioned a moment ago, to actually expand mental health care in this region. I mean, one thing that came up a lot in talking with folks about Pocasset is that the facility itself is actually pretty new. It is not one of these kind of like crumbling, falling down buildings, out of date. And half the building is empty. So people are really saying, like, we should be spending more to use this space for inpatient beds, perhaps an outpatient clinic. You know, this is a place that knows how to help people in this particular kind of mental health crisis. It should be used. But again, the good news is that Pocasset remains open for now. And that's worth celebrating for the advocates who require it.
That is CAI's Eve Zukoff. Eve, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Eve is stepping away, but we'll have her back at the end of the show to talk about our collaborative project with the Martha's Vineyard Times on the soaring cost of home insurance. Last week, CAI learned that local offshore wind developer Vineyard Offshore is cutting 50 jobs. CAI's Jeanette Barnes is here with that story, and she'll also bring us a more upbeat business story about a new startup bringing oceanographic technology to the market. Hiya, Jeanette.
Hi, Steve.
So let's talk about the wind jobs. These jobs were at Vineyard Offshore, but they don't affect Vineyard Wind. Could you start by just explaining all of this?
Sure. So these were 50 job cuts at the company Vineyard Offshore, which is one of two parent companies of Vineyard Wind, the actual offshore wind project. A spokesperson for Vineyard Offshore tells me that Vineyard Wind itself, the project, and the people who work for that project were not affected directly by these layoffs. The company says these 50 cuts were a mix of layoffs of current employees, plus eliminating some unfilled positions. And some of them were regular employees and some were contractors. The company also said that these cuts were spread across.
We seem to be having difficulty with the Zoom connection there. Let's see if we can get Jeanette back. Okay. All right. We're going to step away to the break. We'll be right back with Jeanette Barnes. This is the News Roundup on CAI. We are talking about the top local stories of the week with reporters and editors from around the region. I'm Steve Junker. Before we went to the break, we were speaking with CAI's Jeanette Barnes about Vineyard Offshore cutting 50 jobs. Jeanette Barnes, we have you back?
Yes, we do.
Okay. You were telling us about the relationship between this offshore wind company, Vineyard Offshore, and the company Vineyard Wind, which is building and looking to operate turbines just south of the islands.
Right. So they have these 50 job cuts, a mix of layoffs and eliminated positions that were at Vineyard Offshore, the parent company, not directly at Vineyard Wind, the project. And it was a mix of regular employees and contractors who were laid off. The company says that these positions were in the U.S. and Europe, although all of Vineyard Offshore's listed offices and projects are in the United States. It's sort of the U.S. development partner of a European company. But we have a local office here in New Bedford that was possibly affected. They also have offices in Boston, New York, and California.
We know that the short-term prospects for new offshore wind farms have been hurt by the Trump administration's executive order that's blocking permitting for wind. What did the company have to say about why they decided to make these layoffs? Is there a connection here?
Well, Vineyard Offshore blamed it on what they called recent market uncertainties. And certainly the biggest one of those really has to be President Trump's executive order blocking the permitting for offshore wind, because it's putting new projects essentially on hold. Offshore wind was having kind of a tough time in the last couple of years anyway with rising costs. some companies had backed out of their Massachusetts contracts in the last round. But what they're pointing to here is the current market conditions, which are definitely challenging for offshore wind right now.
I'm wondering, even if the Trump order were lifted today, Vineyard Offshore, it has not been able to get a contract for its next New England project. Is that right?
Right. So they bid their project called Vineyard Wind 2. They bid into the last Massachusetts solicitation. The state did select it, but not for the full number of turbines they had proposed. And the idea was that Connecticut was likely to take the balance because this was part of that multi-state solicitation that we reported on before. Connecticut, however, chose to be silent on what they would take until after the election, although they didn't explicitly say that's what they were doing. But in the end, after the election, they chose to support solar projects instead. So without that Connecticut buy-in, then Vineyard Offshore said it was not going to be able to build Vineyard Wind 2 right away.
Let's turn to a story that you reported this week about a technology that could be used for offshore wind, but will probably be used for other emerging offshore purposes as well. It's been around for a few years in the research world, but it's now being commercialized, and it was developed right here in Woods Hole. Tell us about this.
Yes, this is an autonomous underwater vehicle. It's called the Orpheus. It was developed at Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution several years ago. But what's new now is that it has been licensed to a company in New Bedford formed for the purpose of producing more of them and using them commercially. Again, this vehicle is called the Orpheus, and it is autonomous, meaning there is no remote control. It doesn't need a person on a ship telling it where to go. And these have been around for a while, but one thing that's different about the Orpheus is how deep it is capable of going, to the deepest parts of the ocean, about 36,000 feet down. The commercial applications for the Orpheus probably won't even need to use that full depth right away. They are going to be probably surveying the ocean floor for the laying of cable and things like that. But the goal of this new company, which is called Orpheus Ocean, is to do it less expensively than it's being done now.
I know you went to see the original Orpheus, the research vehicles, at HUI. What was it like?
It's always cool to see a piece of scientific equipment like this up close. It's really deceptively simple looking from the outside. It's oblong, almost like a little submarine. It's about 5.5 feet long. And the outer hull of it is just like these sort of sheets of orange plastic. They're not watertight, but it's the stuff inside that's very watertight and able to resist those depths. There's a mass of wires in there and clear tubing. There's a glass sphere that holds all of the really technical things, the cameras and things like that. And then it stands on a metal frame, a thin frame. It kind of reminded me of like those U-shaped aluminum legs on a lawn chair. That's what it stands on.
Then after visiting the research lab where it was developed, you went to New Bedford, where there's this startup company that's licensed this technology to build more of these Orpheus underwater vehicles there in New Bedford for commercial purposes. Tell us about this startup lab or startup company.
Yeah, sure. This company, Orpheus Ocean, has two founders. One was an engineer from who actually worked on creating the Orpheus, and the other one is someone who has been in venture capital and was working at Woods Hole with a private venture capital partner prior to this. So they're both very familiar with the Orpheus. They're in a rented space at a nonprofit group in New Bedford that does kind of tech business incubation. And it has all the things they need, including this big overhead crane that can pick up the vehicle once it's built because it weighs about 500 pounds. Jake Russell is one of the founders that I spoke with, and he says his vision as they build out these he calls them robots, these vehicles at their location is to use it for offshore wind, but also other things like laying fiber optic cable. He said companies like Google and Meta are building their own internet connections under the ocean. So that is one example of something it could be used for.
Now, I understand that they've built their first Orpheus model there. What's next for the company?
Well, they are getting ready for their first mission, which is to take some photos and videos of the seafloor in May. They're going to be going near Guam to do that. They'll be also taking samples of sediment. And Orpheus Ocean has signed an agreement to be part of a project called Seabed 2030, which is creating a worldwide digital map of the ocean floor. I did ask Jake a little bit about, you know, this issue with the offshore wind kind of being in a tough spot right now. And he said he knew he was going to have to work with nonprofits and research groups first to kind of establish the reliability of the technology anyway.
That is CAI's Jeanette Barnes. Jeanette, thank you.
Thanks, Steve.
You're listening to the News Roundup on CAI. The Steamship Authority has been looking to fill its top two leadership roles, the general manager and the chief operating officer, but now it has announced a new chief operating officer, or COO. Louisa Hufstetter of the Vineyard Gazette profiled Mark Amundson, and she is here with the story. Hi, Louisa.
Good morning, Steve. Yes, Mark Amundson was an inside hire, but not an old-timer with the steamship. He came on board for the newly created position of Director of Marine Operations in 2019. And that position had been created after the big management consultation report that took a whole year to study the steamship operations. They recommended this position. Mark Amundson was hired from a pretty thoroughgoing career at sea for about three decades at least.
Tell us about that, because he, in your profile, you talked to him about how he came into this role, and he has a long history in maritime endeavors, but not just himself, his whole family comes from a background that way.
Yes, I discovered this when I was checking to make sure I was spelling his name right. I said Amundson, like the polar explorer Roald Amundson, first to the South Pole, and he said that was my great-great-great-uncle, and confirmed that his father's great-great-uncle, and was a Norwegian explorer, didn't have any children of his own, but it's still a proud family history, and Mark's own father was an oceanographer, and who had some connections, including getting the young Mark a job assisting Dr. Harold Edgerton at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology in doing underwater experiments to develop side scan sonar, which is used in underwater exploration.
So
then he went to sea,
and he did a lot of sort of work on keeping ships in operation in a big way, like in industrial shipping yards. Tell us what he's going to be doing for the Steamship Authority.
Well, he is going to be overseeing everything he was already doing, which was engineering and maintenance. They changed the title, I think, last year. And that's everything involving the boats and how they run. And this will, you know, as chief operating officer, he'll be also responsible for everything else, including the terminals and the website, the development of the new reservations system for automobiles, which has been under, you know, is still not begun despite long searching for the right company and the right way to do it. They are now, I believe, conducting, you know, the interviews to determine who's going to develop this reservation system. It's a complex project. But he said he's up for the challenge. He's also run ferry systems of his own in the past, in between Canada and Maine, and between Spain and Morocco in the Mediterranean.
There has been some pushback about naming him to this position when there is not a new general manager. A new general manager has to be found. Would a new general manager have a different priority for this position or want a different person in it? You can understand why there's questions around this.
There have been questions around this. I talked to the Martha's Vineyard representative to the Boatline Board of Governors, James Malkin, and he said, no, he would not want to put all of these important projects on hold while they conduct a search for the new COO. And they do have this very, very qualified man who has run shipyards, you know, has fixed ferries, knows both sides of the job, and it seems ready to step right in, which he actually already has done. The job has begun. They haven't said anything about replacing the former position. There's been a lot of talk about how many other very qualified employees they have. So we'll see how that shakes out.
And do we have any update on what happens with the general manager position, Robert Davis, who is kind of still in the position at least until October, but has announced that he's not going to be there after that?
Well, he's going to be in some sort of advisory position, I think, while the new general manager gets on board. And that process does not really have a firm timeline yet, because the subcommittee of people from the Board of Governors and the Port Council have interviewed four executive search firms, and I think they're meeting next week to decide which search firm will actually conduct the search. So you can see this is a longer timeline. And if anything, you know, if you'd asked me, I would be actually relieved if I were the new general manager to have a very, very experienced and qualified chief operating officer already on the job.
It's Louisa Hufstetter of the Vineyard Gazette. Louisa, thank you so much.
Thank you, Steve.
Sometimes a locally owned business can really seem to anchor a community. And in the Cape region, that may often be a local market. In Chatham, owners of the only grocery store are selling the business, which represents a big change for the town. Tim Wood of the Cape Cod Chronicle has details. Hi, Tim.
Hi, Steve.
This is the Chatham Village Market. Some people may be wondering why it would be a big deal.
Well, it's a big deal because, as you said, it's the only market, the only supermarket in town here. And it's been a real anchor in the community for the 22 years that it's been open. You know, it's the kind of place where local organizations like Scouts or nonprofit groups turn to for donations when they're looking to hold, you know, bake sales or things like that. And the owners have always been very generous, and they've always emphasized the community ties that they've held. You know, they started the market, as I said, 22 years ago when the AMP, you know, we all remember the AMP markets. They used to be all over the Cape and Islands. They closed most of their stores in the area in about 2002. And at the time, this group of three guys, Jeff Heap, Scott McDonald, and Bob White, they were all working for AMP in different areas. And one was working in a Chatham store, another had worked here, another was a local district manager. And, you know, they saw that, you know, Chatham was going to be without a supermarket, without any kind of food store. And they got together and they negotiated an agreement to take over the lease on one of the two A&P markets that were in Chatham at the time. This one is located right at the near the traffic lights near downtown. And, you know, they ran the market for a number of years, but they had a little bit of a glitch in 2011 when the property owner was planning to convert the building into a new CVS after a lot of negotiations. And this really showed the support in town that the market had. Some folks in town started a petition to convince the owners of the real estate to let the market stay at the site, and they collected over 17,000 signatures. Mm. You know, that's quite a lot in a town of 6,000 year-round residents. You know, it just shows how the market's influence and their it just extended into not only the year-round community but also the summer folks here.
What's going to happen next now? If they're stepping aside, who comes in, and is it will still be a market?
It will still be the market. They're selling the business to a West Yarmouth resident named Harsh Patel, who also owns the Dennis Public Market. And we talked with him for our story this week. He's, you know, familiar with the area. His market in Dennis now does a lot of wholesale work with local restaurants. So he's been to town here and he services some of the restaurants. So he knows the market, and he said that, you know, it works the way it is now. He doesn't plan to make any major changes. He said he's going to keep the store's 43 year-round employees and not really change the operation. You know, he said he kind of has some plans that of things that he could do differently and maybe expand some things, catering, et cetera. But he seems to understand the importance that the market has to the town, and the three current owners say that, you know, they wouldn't have sold to someone who they didn't believe would carry on their legacy and keep this tradition going. So they're comfortable with it. And hopefully the local residents will also continue to shop there. You know, it's the kind of friendly place where you go in and they know your name and you know, the cashier calls you hun, that kind of thing, you know. And we're expecting that to continue. They're all going to stay there, and we're pretty happy about that.
Anytime a local business like that changes hands, people are on edge and they're paying attention. Let's hope it continues to work out for Chatham. Tim Wood of the Cape Cod Chronicle. Tim, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me, Steve.
The Trump administration is firing or otherwise terminating the employment of many federal workers. The impact has come to the Cape Cod National Seashore, where three employees were fired on Valentine's Day. William Von Herf of the Provincetown Independent has the story and joins us. Hi, William.
Hi, Steve. Thanks for having me.
Tell us what we know about the positions of these three people.
So the three people who were fired, there was Dan Zotto, who was the chief archaeologist. There was John Hanlon, who's a park ranger that specializes in outreach. And there was an additional person who is a restoration ecologist who specializes in the Herring River Restoration Project. And crucially, there isn't another archaeologist on staff. And as far as I understand it, there's no other park ranger specializing in outreach either. Nor do I think there's a restoration ecologist that specializes in the Herring River, though there are other ecologists on staff.
Hmm. How does this, before we get further into this, just explain how this fits into the bigger picture in terms of what we know is happening nationally?
Yeah, so the Trump administration sent out this sort of form email to, I believe, around 1,000 probationary national park workers. And probationary meaning that they had been on the job less than a year, although in many cases these are people who have worked in the national park system for quite a long time. For instance, John Hanlon had been a seasonal ranger for 25 seasons. But because they're within the first year of their job, it is quite easy for the federal government to terminate them. And when these people are terminated, they don't get severance or benefits or anything like that. Their job just ends effective immediately. And so this is something that's happening in the National Park Service, but it's also happening across the federal government. There's something in the range of 200,000 probationary employees. And the most recent number I saw from the New York Times was that 30,000 of them have been let go. So this is definitely part of a sort of broader purge of federal employees that are easy to fire.
The one employee that you spoke to here, Daniel Zotto, he told you that the email he received firing him was essentially a cut and paste statement. Describe that for us.
So the cut and paste statement essentially said that in the most general terms, the employee that received it did not meet the qualifications or was performing to an insufficient level to warrant their continued employment. And again, it's complicated because technically this is something that the federal government can absolutely do. But whether or not that's actually accurate doesn't seem to be taken into account here, like whether or not they were actually fulfilling their job qualifications, considering 1,000 people received the exact same email with just their name and the position swapped into the sort of blank.
Okay, I want to talk a little bit about the roles that these people played and why Park Service folks feel like these are really important positions. Pick one of them and tell us about it.
Well, I spoke to a number of people about John Hanlon. I spoke to David Bernstein, who is the president of the Friends of the Cape Cod National Seashore. And he went on about all the work that John Hanlon does to bring the park to people, that it isn't as simple as just welcoming people in, but also he went out to speak to Alzheimer's patients, for instance, or would go to schools up in the Boston area and bring them into the park. Another former ranger that I spoke with, Mark Adams, who works closely with John Hanlon and has for years, spoke about just how amazing John was at bringing people into the park and giving people who might otherwise not get a chance to experience nature at all this amazing opportunity to see what is, in my opinion, one of the most spectacular natural places in the state of Massachusetts. And I heard stories like this for all three people. It was really quite touching. There's sort of a universal understanding that what these three people were doing was really important.
And the ostensible reason from the federal level is this is cost savings. One of the people you spoke to points out that these people are not paid very much. This is not something people do. This is almost a sense of mission position, I guess, is what I'm saying.
Absolutely. I mean, it was difficult to find an exact number. I saw the sort of salary range from anywhere from like $30,000 to $50,000 per year. But regardless, on the scale of the federal budget, that's really nothing. Probationary employees are almost by definition the lowest paid employees, and they work so hard. And often the probationary status only comes after having done contract work or seasonal work or sometimes even volunteer work in positions like this. And the idea that these people are like, you know, taking away so much taxpayer money, it just doesn't hold up to reality. The vast majority of expenses within the federal government do not come from Park Service employees. And these people, as David Bernstein, the president of the Friends of the Seashore, said, so these people are doing it just because they love it. This is the thing that brings them joy and they believe allows them to contribute to the world. And I don't know, the idea that those are the people that the administration would target is really heartbreaking.
It's William Von Herf of the Provincetown Independent, where you can read the story. William, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me, Steve.
You're listening to the News Roundup. I'm Steve Junker. We're going to the break now. When we come back, we'll hear from David Creed of Nantucket Current. Stay with us. This is the local news roundup on CAI. I'm Steve Junker. We are talking about the top local stories of the week with the journalists who cover them. Concerns about bird deaths continue in the region and particularly on Nantucket. David Creed of Nantucket Current has fresh details from the island. Hi, David.
Hi, Steve. Good morning.
Good morning. We are talking about hundreds of birds being found dead on island beaches. Originally, the concern here was bird flu, but the first round of testing doesn't seem to point to that as the cause. Is that right?
Correct. So they tested on Nantucket, Nantucket Animal Rescue, Blair Perkins and Rain Harbison. They tested 93 birds earlier this month, and just three came back to be the bird flu, the H5N1 virus. And so they're kind of shifting gears. They're going to start testing for the Wellfleet Bay virus as well as Newcastle disease, both in neurological illnesses that they think could be at the root of this bird death problem. But they're also starting to do brainstem tests. Normally they've been doing nasal swabs, but they're finding that the virus they're not shedding the virus as quickly at the brain. So they're going to start doing these brain swabs. And I guess off island, according to Blair Perkins, who he's one of the co-founders of Nantucket Animal Rescue, more tests have been coming up positive by using the brainstem swab method. So it's kind of in wait and see mode right now, but over 240 birds were found dead in less than 2 miles of beach on Coast 2 last weekend. So it seems to be much worse this year than in recent years.
Let's go into that a little bit more. That more than 240 birds seems like an awful lot. What is the sense of the scale of this die-off compared to different years?
So Blair Perkins, who grew up here, he said this is one of the largest he's ever seen on the island. And they had told me, and before I interviewed them, and then shortly after they went out to Coast 2, because they had been out the week prior, and they said there were so many birds, they didn't even have the resources to be able to, you know, bring a lot in for testing. So they went out the next week, and I was given a report of 248 birds found about 1.5 miles of beach in Coast 2, and they are saying this is as bad as they've ever seen it, Nantucket Animal Rescue is saying. So they're really trying to get to the root of the problem. It's why they're going to start testing for more illnesses outside of the bird flu. It sounds like these tests for Wellfleet Bay virus and Newcastle disease will take place in New Hampshire. The tests are about $20 to $25 per test. If you want it, and also Nantucket Animal Rescue is a nonprofit. They run on donations. So if anybody listening to this is interested in supporting them, you can go to our website, nantucketcurrent.com. You can read the story, and there's a link in the story.
Tell us, when we say birds, what are we talking about? What kinds of birds?
They're long-tailed ducks, razorbills, gulls, hawks. I mean, there's scooters, like there's eiders, there's some, you know, in the report that I got from Rain Harbison, another co-founder of Nantucket Animal Rescue, there's 68 unidentified birds that were found dead. So she gave me a list of over a dozen different birds. And there's some that they can't even identify.
I'm wondering about the concern. They speak a little bit about the concern for, people walking the beach with their pets, because these are birds mostly found on the beaches, right?
Correct. Yeah. So they have been very clear about making sure that your animals are leashed when you're walking on the beaches because they don't want people's pets to be getting sick as well. In particular, cats are more likely to get sick, especially from a bird that has the bird flu, that has the H5N1 virus. So cats are more in danger than dogs, but they are saying to leash any animals as you're walking the beach.
Is this a moment they're kind of cautioning people not to panic here, even though this seems like something big is going on?
Yeah, for now they're telling people not to panic. They're trying to make sure that people follow these safe precautions just to keep their pets safe. But right now it's more of a wait and see approach because there is a concern that of the three, there were just three of 93 birds that came back positive for the bird flu. But there is a concern that once they start doing the brainstem testing, that more of those birds are going to come up positive. So it is really a wait and see kind of moment right now, and I'm sure in the coming weeks and months we're going to have more information on this.
It's David Creed of Nantucket Current, where you can read all about it. David, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me, Steve. Have a good weekend.
You're listening to the local news roundup on CAI. I'm Steve Junker. Martha's Vineyard has seen the third highest rate of dropped homeowners insurance of any community in the country. It's a consequence of climate change that may not be the most obvious, but is perhaps the most immediately painful for thousands of locals. CAI's Eve Zukoff and Sarah Shaw Dawson from the Martha's Vineyard Times are here to talk about how they covered this story together. Eve, welcome back.
Hi, thanks for having me back.
And Sarah, welcome.
Hi, Steve. Thank you so much for having me.
Let's start with how the story began. Sarah, the Martha's Vineyard Times heard from a whole lot of islanders about the pain of home insurance. Tell us what happened.
Yeah, so it all started with a story we published this past November about large home insurance companies leaving the island. More than four national insurers stopped covering homes here in a short time and left a really huge gap in services that Mass Fair Plan and local agents struggled to fill. A U.S. Senate report soon after found that Martha's Vineyard had one of the highest rates of non-renewals in the country. So the NV Times put out a survey asking locals about their personal experiences with this, and over 300 people responded to it. It was shocking how many islanders had similar stories there. It was like a burst of energy after and went from maybe this is something interesting to wow, this is a huge deal for people here and across the country.
So a lot of people responding to this story. Eve, at that point, the Times and CAI partnered to dive deeper into these responses to better understand what was happening here. I'm curious, as you looked at these stories and these comments, Eve, what did you notice about them?
Yeah, we noticed a lot of troubling themes almost immediately. I mean, first of all, according to the survey results, about 30% of respondents said that they had been dropped by an insurance provider over the last several years. And then for cost, 42% said that their insurance had increased between 30 and 50%. And then a quarter said that their insurance increased by more than 50%. So by the numbers, it was stunning. And then there were the more human details that people had included on this survey. There were vineyarders who described delaying retirement, avoiding knee replacement surgeries, skipping meals with friends, and debating moves off island for good.
Sarah, one person you really focused on in your reporting was Bob Finbow. Tell us about his struggle.
Yeah, absolutely. Bob Finbow is a local who wrote into the survey. His story really clarified a lot of points with this insurance issue as a whole. First off, his renewal notice was over 360% increase from his previous year's premium. His yearly rate went from $3,200 to $11,900. And his life story was riveting. This is someone who worked for decades to build not only their own life, but help their neighbors as well. When he saw there wasn't a Wi-Fi operator on the small island of Chappaquiddick where he lives, he built a Wi-Fi tower in his own backyard and supplied Wi-Fi for everyone. When he saw the gap of EMTs there, he became one. Bob Finbow is a great example of a proactive, caring citizen who was put in a tough spot by his insurance company. And after all that work, he can't even retire because of how high his insurance costs are now. He's even having to consider selling the home that he's lived in since he was 8 years old and move off of the island. When asked what getting that renewal notice felt like, he said he was sent right back to being 8 years old after a tornado destroyed his family's farm in Minnesota. That's the reason his family moved to the island in the first place. This insurance issue hit so close to home for him, literally. And the kicker is, he has to just pay it. It's not just about the one increase, it's the trend that scares him, and it scares many others too. If cost has jacked up this much in a year, how much will it be in 5 years? He's really at the whim of these big companies, and he's not alone by a long shot.
Mm. Eve, you and Sarah interviewed people who shared what they happened when they realized they simply can't afford what the insurers are offering. How are some of the other people that you spoke with dealing with this lack of affordability?
Yeah, I'll mention two here. First, Deb Mello Orazum. She taught for 27 years on Martha's Vineyard. She's retired now on a fixed income. She learned that her insurance provider last September was dropping her, and then she kind of scrambled, like people do. She found a different insurance company, but they would only cover her home if she paid $9,000 a year. The average in Massachusetts is like $1,500 for context. So it was completely unaffordable to her. So she joined what other people in Massachusetts have to join when they can't afford their home insurance anymore, which is the Mass Fair Plan, which acts as a market of last resort for Massachusetts residents to stay insured. But they're limited policies. Many people on it are underinsured. Like, they only cover up to $1 million in replacement costs if your home is destroyed, which is plenty to rebuild almost anywhere, but not really on Martha's Vineyard, where even a modest house can cost much more. I also talked with a 90-year-old Chilmark resident named Peter McGee, who found that he could only really afford his insurance if he dropped coverage for named storms. So we're talking, like, if a huge hurricane or nor'easter comes and messes up his house, he foots the whole bill. He saw his policy jump 50% in a single year to $6,000 without the named storm clause. His insurance went back to $1,500 per year. So he said he just has to hope he won't see a Hurricane Bob in his lifetime.
Sarah, I know you also spoke with State Senator Julian Sear and others about possible solutions to this home insurance problems. What did you hear?
Well, State Senator Julian Sear spoke with The Times again recently, and he told us again that he's heard from a lot of his constituents about this for a long time. So he's introducing two bills that he says will hopefully help homeowners navigate this changing market. They're a long-term solution, so they won't bring these big companies back to the island or the Cape after they left. But if they're passed, these bills may help cover homes that are in flood zones and address the climate angle of all of this in general. There's one specific bill that's geared toward private flood insurance. The other is about initiating a grant program for homeowners who want to fortify their homes from climate change, storms, and natural disasters. So these are things to be hopeful about, but there's a long way to go. He did say there are hearings coming up, Zoom optional, where locals can tune in and chime in about how they feel about home insurance generally and the bills themselves. So people can look out for those hearings on mylegislature.gov coming up this spring, summer, and fall.
I want to repeat that this was kind of a unique reporting collaborative between Martha's Vineyard Times and CAI here. Eve, the response online when you did a social media video around this and just online generally, it's a story about insurance, but people are really charged up about it.
They really are. Yeah, we did this minute and a half long video about this story. We got 1,400 likes, 75 comments, 720 shares. People from all over Massachusetts, Rhode Island, New York began commenting with their stories, talking about, how they had left the island last spring impartially over this. There were fights in the comments. Someone who just tagged Governor Mara Healey, which I kind of liked. And there was a conversation also about how the island's overall trend towards luxuryization, if you will, has contributed. So we were told in no uncertain terms, people are hurting. They want to talk about this.
That is CAI's Eve Zukoff and Sarah Shaw Dawson from the Martha's Vineyard Times. Thank you both.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
That's our show for today. I want to thank all my guests. We heard from CAI's Eve Zuckoff and Jeanette Barnes. We spoke with Louisa Hufstetter of the Vineyard Gazette, Tim Wood of the Cape Cod Chronicle, William Von Herf of the Provincetown Independent. We heard from David Creed of Nantucket Current and Sarah Shaw Dawson of the Martha's Vineyard Times. Big thanks to Dan Treadle for engineering the program. His hand on the tiller steers us through the waves. That's all we've got. In Woods Hole, I'm Steve Junker. Talk to you next week.